When Blake Morrison's father was dying of cancer, he started keeping a journal, looking back at his troubled relationship with the parent he was about to lose. That journal became an award-winning book, and now it's been made into a film. When Did You Last See Your Father opens this Friday, June 6th, at the Angelica, Lincoln Plaza Cinemas in Cinema 1, 2, and 3. And joining me now is director Nan Tucker and one of its stars, Colin Firth. And I'm very pleased to welcome them to the show today. Hello.
Good morning.
Hi.
Were you familiar with the book before you became a part of the film, Anand?
I knew about the book because one has to remember when it was published 13, 14 years ago, it was the first almost of these kind of literary confessional memoirs. Now you can't walk through borders without falling over them, you know, left, right and center. But at the time, that had just come out and Nick Hornby's Fever Pitch came out around the same time. And I was a bit of an Arsenal fan, so I ended up reading Fever Pitch.
Sports really do determine the memoir that you choose. What about you, Colin?
Well, for me, it was When Did You Last See Your Father, actually. Somebody recommended it to me for quite short.
Why, are you a Chelsea fan? Or?
No, I'm an Arsenal fan.
He's
as well.
A gunner
I've done
too.
A film of Fever Pitch.
Yeah.
So, no, this is all sounding rather incestuous yeah. now. But no, I've starred in the film Anne's talking about, but I also, in fact, starred in both films we've just...
You've covered the two major memoirs of the time.
No, so When Did You Last See Your Father? I think there were a lot of people who seized on it, and an old friend of mine was one of those.
Well, I'm sure everybody sees, to some degree, growing himself or herself growing up in this kind of situation, because it's about seeing your parent in one way and then, of course, realizing that it's a little more complicated. But when you started, Jim Broadbent plays your father, Arthur Morrison, a doctor, you jump right in. So you have to suggest all of the things that we later discover, all the nuances, without ever revealing them. How did you work that out?
It was an interesting task for me, really, because we see Blake's character at different stages of his life, played by different actors, and an awful lot of the actions, the turning points, and the huge obstacles that the boys had growing up are already established in the other parts of the film, and I'm a kind of, you know, they're all deposited in my bit without me having a great deal to... to interact with it. I'm just the recipient of a lot of very outdated teenage bitterness. I think it follows the pattern in a way of a man who's gone beyond all that and has been very successful in his life and doesn't carry resentment about his parents around with him. But of course, as soon as he gets back within a few feet of his father, the old patterns come. You know, as soon as you hear that tone of voice, the reflexes kick in again.
Well, the film, Anand, is structured with flashbacks. Could you have told it in a straight chronological order?
I'm sure one could have done, but I think the book itself is structured in that way, and it's a kind of meditation on memory as much as anything else, a meditation on the idea of family and what it means to be a son to a father, a father to your own children. And so I think what we wanted to try to do was in some ways reflect the experience of the book, and the film itself is a very point of view movie. What we're trying to do is make you feel like what it was like to be Blake while he was experiencing this last days of his father's life.
But at the same time, I'm sure you shot each one separately. You probably shot the young Blake first and then the adult Blake second, or vice versa.
Well, we had 6 weeks to shoot it in, so we had to shoot everything all jumbled up all the time.
Oh, you did it? You shot it the way you eventually edited it?
Well, we had all the various ages of man around at different times, didn't we? We had all three generations of
ships in the night. Yes, I'd pass Blake at all sorts of ages. I found myself...
You saw yourself as a young child and a teenager.
I found myself stumbling into Blake's 17-year-old bedroom at one point, which was a strangely resonant place to be, because Blake is actually not terribly much older than I am. I mean, we've got about 10 years between us, and so I recognize the Airfix models and the boys' own annuals and those pre-computer teenage entertainments.
You mean the real Blake Morrison?
The real Blake Morrison is probably about, yeah.
What a
is
decade
he?
Older than
Yeah, he's about 10 years older.
And did you have much contact while you were filming this?
We had a bit. Blake actually, I think, is worldly enough in the business of film adaptation to know that he was best served not pressurizing anybody. He showed up as an extra. He made a very, very quiet appearance, actually. I didn't even know he was there until he quietly, one of the extras came up and introduced himself as Blake Morrison. And it was a very generous and very wise way for him to behave, because you know, you're going to be in awe. The writer's always your god a little bit. I mean, he's the creator of this universe that you're, you know, trying to bring to life. And but in this case, my author was also the character I was trying to inhabit. So I, you know, it could have been overwhelming, but he completely stood back. You know.
Well, this is not the first adaptation you've been involved with in end. Have you always been happier when the author has stayed out of the way? Because some authors have told me that they have wanted to stay out of the way, and then the directors have invited them because they felt that they could learn things by picking their brains.
I have absolutely no problem collaborating with the people who've created the material on which you're trying to create your film. You know,
because film is collaboration anyway.
Film is a collaboration. I think, you know, the thing I always try to do at the beginning of any of that process is sit down with the author, look them in the eye and say, okay, you've got to look me in the eye now. And at this moment, you've got to decide whether you're going to take a leap of faith in me or not, because you're going to have to jump. And I'm going to trash your life, work, whatever, and I'm going to turn it into something that you have will not recognize in any shape or form until maybe at the very end when you see the movie. Hopefully you'll feel that the emotional temperature or color of it is still truthful.
Well, often novelists say, you know, I sold the book, it became a movie, it's something different. But it's a little different when the character's name is your name.
Well, I think that, as I said, I mean, I just want to add that I usually welcome any source material being available that I can possibly get. I mean, I would have been very happy to have Blake there every day. And when he showed up, it was always helpful. But what he did that was so generous was to acknowledge that we were going to have to usurp his material, turn it into something of our own, render it unrecognizable, as Anand says, in the hope of actually returning to him something of the essence of what he did.
Well, it's a memoir written in the first person, yeah, which, of course, doesn't lend itself very well to film unless you do total voiceover. But did it give you insights into the character when you read that? Because you knew things that had gone on in his head that you might not actually say explicitly in the film, but knew
it
was there.
Although I think the primary source was always on the page. You
but
know.
Also it's yourself, isn't it? And I think what was interesting for me was how much you and Jim ended up bringing yourselves to the role. You know, in the end, you sort of walk... When you start shooting the film, don't you think you walk away from the material in a way and you end up actually just bringing yourself?
Exactly. I think anything that's interpretive, that has to go through that. You have your source as a starting point. Then you have to own it. And you will not have anything of substance unless you go through that process. It has to become entirely yours. And so the character I was playing was a hybrid of, I suppose, bits of Blake, bits of me, bits of Peter who adapted it, you know?
And you were lucky that you're working with someone like Jim Broadbent, who is such an amazing actor. You can really bounce off of him. He's playing a character who has what we might call a big personality, the kind of father who can overwhelm a shy child.
Well, that's true.
And the kid is judging him constantly. And
I think I mean, it's fairly familiar to an awful lot of people who are the only person in the room cringing while their father's charming everybody, you know, flirting with girls your own age. Everyone's saying, what's something? Your dad's absolutely...
He's flirting with your girlfriend.
Yes. And at the same time, you have a desperate need to be taken seriously. You know, you're 17. It's, you know, you don't see yourself as a kid anymore. And you're trying to get interest from women by saying you've read Dostoevsky, you know, and you still haven't shed the acne, and it's all delicately poised, and you've accumulated all these things in your arsenal which are going to launch you on the world and get you taken seriously, and then your father's there to undermine it all and remind everybody that you're an insignificant child, and it's excruciating, and nobody else sees it as a great act of cruelty, but to be in the receiving end when you're that fragile, I think, is devastating. And something which you may well think you've got over by the time you're 20, but that's obviously it's just that awful rule that, you know, it's the same tone of voice, the same circumstances, when you come back 20 years later, just bring it all back.
Well, Blake is not like his father. Now, his father is charming, and you see why women especially are seduced by him, but he is also at times a rather... somebody who's overbearing and who overdoes it, and a sensitive kid would be embarrassed by him. But perhaps every sensitive kid is embarrassed by the parent. That's part of adolescence, isn't it?
And also, I think, isn't it part of adolescence that you want to kill your parents? Isn't that the deal?
Yes.
Well, I never wanted to kill my father, but I would have liked to have maimed him a few times.
You've got to, otherwise you'd never leave home, I guess.
Well, no, Jung tells you that you have to. Mm. So, but I think that's true. I don't think, you know, I was deeply embarrassed about my parents at that age, and they did nothing to deserve that, really.
No. Now but you could still draw upon those emotions.
I can still, I can find all sorts of things to accuse them of.
Do you know if the title has any connection to the William Frederick Yeames painting of the same name?
Well, I think it's yes.
Because
I
mean, it's not mentioned in the film, but...
Blake definitely knew of the painting.
I think that the title is with an assumption that you are familiar with that.
Yeah. Well, British people would, but Americans might not.
Possibly. I mean, I think it's... You know, this was the title of a book. And I think it was... it actually also became the title of the piece of poetry that I read as a voiceover.
Well, because that piece is part of the... And Blake was a poet before he wrote the novel. So the end of the book is this beautiful piece of writing, which is a poem and is the title of the film and was inspired probably in his head by this painting, which is it in the Liverpool Museum of Modern Art, I think?
It features a little boy during the English Civil War being asked in front of his mother and sister, where... is your father.
It's a painting of betrayal. Yeah.
People argue about what actually the intention was when did you last see your father. I mean, I think that popularly I grew up with the idea that it was Charles II's son being asked where the whereabouts of his father who was fleeing from the Cromwellian soldiers.
Snitch him.
Sell out your dad. there's the long passage, which I find absolutely beautiful towards the end of the film, which where Blake asks this question, when did you last see your father? When was the last moment when you saw him when he was really himself?
Because now he's dying of cancer.
Well, he's dying, and so he describes his father as dying not at once, but in a series of depletions, so that every day he seems less like himself, and every day we thought he cannot possibly be less himself than he is today, and every day he was, and that was the heartbreak. So he says, when did you last see your father? I mean, I'm paraphrasing now, but was it when you closed the casket? Was it when he actually sat up and said something? Was it when you shared a joke? Was it when you argued? When was he last himself?
This isn't the first time you've collaborated on a film, and you were the producer on The Girl with a Pearl Earring. Mm-hmm. But you were already directing at that point, weren't you?
Directing is my main gig. But
Hillary and Jackie, was that the first big one?
That was my first big movie, yeah. I'd done a small film about Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, the author of The Little Prince, before then. But I have an independent film company in London, and as a result, I've also produced a couple of films. I mean, I wasn't the main producer on Girl with the Pearl Earring, but that's how we got to know each other, and the director, Peter Weber, was someone who had been my editor on my first film, and it was a bit of a family affair.
It was, yes.
And then Steve Martin with Shop Girl as well. You're producing Incendiary, too?
That's right, which is directed by my partner, mother of my child. That was entertaining. I wouldn't recommend that to everybody.
Who directed me and Bridget Jones.
Who directed you and Bridget Jones. Oh, it's so incestuous. In England, there's like five people in the film business, and we are two of them. So.
Well, in the case of Colin, it seems like he's the only one who's getting a lot of acting work. Moviegoers will be able to see a lot of you this summer. Yeah, Helen Hunt's Then She Found Me was released last month. There's this film, When Did You Last See Your Father, which opens this weekend. There's Mamma Mia, the film version of the ABBA musical. That'll be in theaters in July.
And so it goes on.
And The Accidental Husband opens in August. That's already opened in England, even though it's an American
Accidental
film.
Husband came, yes, already, and last year. So, I mean, it's...
Work out that way?
I have no control over this, and I certainly wouldn't have, decided to carpet bomb the United States with my with my recent
Well, you're always welcome.
Thank you. No, I mean, this stuff is... some of these go back a couple of years.
It's your late bid for the vice presidential nomination,
yes,
is that right?
Well, you told The Australian last month that you'd like to do other things for a while. What would you like to do?
Well, I've been, that actually made far more, they've made far more of that than I think such things deserve. I mean, I said, yeah, sure. Yeah,
well, Gene Hackman was here recently, and he said, I've quit acting. I mean, the guy's made 80 movies, but he said, I've quit acting. I'm just tired of the business. It just wears you down.
Yes, I mean, I want to get in first. I don't want to wait for burnout. You know, I think it is good to sort of to change tack for a while or to rest or to do other things. I think it's terribly important. I think just for the sake of your output and your work, I think it's a very, very good idea not to just keep at it. And I haven't. I mean, despite what the schedule of releases suggests now, I haven't been working at that rate at all. I have plenty of time in between. And when I said to a journalist, you know, that could be as long as a year and I'd be very happy. Suddenly it was, you know, sabbatical, so it takes a year off acting. Well, I'm halfway through that year already, really. I mean, nobody's going to notice if I take a year off.
And you're on tour. You're promoting a movie.
And it turns this to fill up work, with this I kind think. Of thing. It fills up with this stuff, yeah.
So many people still associate you with your portrayal of Mr. Darcy in Pride and Prejudice. Why do you think that is? Because you, as you said... your approach to the character was to make him as disagreeable as possible.
I was going for that, and it's, you know,
but charming and a bumbler too.
Well, no, I didn't go for charming and bumbler at all, and I don't think that's in it. I think disagreeable's there, and then, you know, I think basically I'm the least qualified person to analyze or deconstruct why it was responded to the way it was. But
well, you seemed like the ideal Darcy. Maybe that was the reason. I mean, that was the Darcy we've all wanted, don't you think?
It for something. When Sharon Maguire, my partner, was casting Bridget, it was just, oh, he's just gorgeous. I mean, you know.
Get some work out of it.
And then, <it's>,
you know what? I don't know how much screen time I have in those 6 hours, but it's not that much. And I think that it's terribly easy to fill up people's imagination with your absence. You know, you make a couple of appearances, and if they light you right and you don't say too much, you know, and then you disappear and then let them talk you up while you're gone.
And the editors really helped him out as well, man, right? He had nothing to do with it.
It's all in the cutting room, love.
So we know what's coming up for you. Are you working on other films?
Nope, I'm taking my year off.
And what about you, Anand?
I hope to make another film very soon. There's a few irons in the fire, so, you know, fingers crossed.
The problem with films is you have a wonderful project, but then you got to get all the financing.
It's being an independent filmmaker, it's never easy.
Meanwhile, we have this one, When Did You Last See Your Father?, which opens on Friday at the Angelica, the Lincoln Plaza Cinemas, and Cinema 1, 2, and 3. And it has been my great pleasure to speak to one of the stars. Well, Colin, you really are. But Jim Broadbent is also in it, and a number of other wonderful people, and two amazing kid actors, don't you think? And the director, Anand Tucker. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.